morning, everybody, and welcome to the Thursday, February 24th, 2022 session of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. I call the meeting to order and ask that commissioners unmute their microphones. And Madam Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Commissioner Villacana?
Present.
Commissioner Moultari?
Here.
Commissioner Simpson-Spearman?
Here.
Commissioner Campbell?
Here.
And Chairman Henry?
Here. Please join me in the flag salute. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Very good. Good morning. The County Planning Commissioners, planning staff, and members of the public wishing to provide live public comment are participating in this meeting using Zoom this morning. Alternative methods for public participation can be found attached to the agenda, as well as a link to the Zoom user guide for public participation. The public may watch or listen to the meeting live online at www.slocounty.ca.gov or on live TV on channel 21. If you're a member of the public wishing to provide live public comment and have joined us by website or smartphone application, when I call for public comment on a specific item, please do so by using the raised hand feature at the bottom of your screen. If you're joining us by phone, please press star 9 to raise your hand. When it's your turn to speak, the clerk will unmute your connection, announce your name or the last three digits of your phone number if you're calling in, and let you know that you're live on the line to make your comments. There'll be time for the usual 3 minutes. If you're streaming the meeting through Channel 1 or the county website and wish to provide live public comment through Zoom, please log in or call in early, as there's an approximate 60-second delay between the meeting and the live stream. Please remember to turn down your broadcast volume when speaking during public comment to reduce interference and feedback noise. So before we get started, there's some minor differences between the published written PDF agenda and what's online. I'm just going to clarify the order that we'll go in today. I propose that we do our staff update and consent agenda as usual, followed by our AB 361 resolution. Then we'll conduct our single hearing item, and then the remainder of the morning session we'll use for the purview workshop. So if I don't have any other thoughts from the commission, we'll proceed in that order. Okay, very good. Thank you. So at this time, we'll open the public comment period for items that are not on the agenda today. If you have a comment on our single hearing item, please hold that until that time. Madam Clerk, do we have any members of the public wishing to make general comments today?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Chair Henry. No pre-recorded messages were received for today's meeting. And at this time, if there is any member of the public that wishes to speak during general public comment, please use the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen or by pressing star 9. And Chair Henry, no requests to speak have been received.
Okay, with that, I'll close public comment and bring it back and look to staff for our update.
Good morning, Chair Henry and Commissioners. Alexandra Fowler, representing the Planning and Building Department. For your update today, we'll start off with recent actions above the Board of Supervisors that pertain to your commission. On their February 15th Board of Supervisors meeting, they took the following actions. The board approved a fee waiver request by the Port San Luis Harbor District to allow the establishment of a temporary construction storage yard for use throughout the restoration of the Avila Pier. As you may recall, spring and summer, your commission took action on some similar request for the development of the Harbor Terrace project. And so this project will be going to you. The only thing that the board has done is decided to waive the fees for processing. The board also held a public hearing to discuss and adopt resolutions approving the 2022 affordable housing projects, the permanent local housing allocation, and the county's inclusionary housing in lieu fees to support affordable housing projects. And so out of that, there may be projects that come to your commission in the future that are benefits, that are benefactors of those adopted resolutions. The board received a quarterly update on the PG&E Diablo Canyon Power Plant decommissioning project and a presentation on the Stanford University and Massachusetts Institute of Technology Diablo Nuclear Canyon Power Plant study. The board reviewed and provided staff direction to process the requested general plan or in general plan and ordinance amendments of Kurt Collins to amend the land use designation of a 15.06 acre parcel from agriculture to residential rural and to create a planning area standard intended to regulate future density and development on the property. And so that particular item will eventually come to your commission for action. The board held a public hearing and acknowledged the California Coastal Commission's modification of the DeSego General Plan and Local Coastal Plan Amendment and adopted a resolution to amend the official maps, which was part three of the coastal land use element. And the March meeting does not have anything on the agenda that would be of purview to your commission. There are also no, there are some appeals that are in the pipeline, but there are none that are currently scheduled for the board between now and May. Regarding your meetings today, as you mentioned at the intro, you'll be participating in your workshop following the hearing items. And that workshop will continue to your meeting on March 10th, which will be fully dedicated to the workshop. Your March 24th meeting has two items tentatively scheduled. The first is a development plan and coastal use permit for the phased development of 10 overnight accommodations and limited support facilities to the Avila Beach Golf Resort, including conversion of an existing barn into public assembly space. And that project's located at 6450 Anna Bay Road and 3000 Avila Beach Drive. And it is located in the community of Avila Beach. There is also a variance minor use permit and coastal development permit request to allow grading on slopes in excess of 30% on a 6,000 square foot lot to allow site development for two residential units. That project is located at 208 Front Street in the community of Avila Beach. And that concludes staff's update. And I'll discuss more about the AB 361 when we get to that item.
Thank you, Ms. Fowler. I do have a question on the Port Authority. The reason that that was, well, I guess a simple question is that temporary construction yard going to be on a site for which that use is permitted? Because that was the disparity previously for the commission.
It's a similar situation as what the previous one was. And so essentially what the board did is they didn't take action on whether or not the use would be permitted. They simply took action as to whether or not the applicant would need to, which is a public entity, would need to pay the processing fees. And so they waived those processing fees. But yes, the situation is fairly similar to the previous one.
So am I given to understand, I thought I heard you say that the matter before us will only be to decide on or not on the fee waiver, not on the actual use of the land?
It will. What will come to you will be the use of the land. The board only took action on whether or not the applicant had to pay the processing fees to move that application request forward.
Very good. And that will, when will that come before us?
It's not scheduled yet. So I hope maybe after your next update, we'll have a better update on that one. But it's a new application that was submitted. So it's still doing its referrals and things like that.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the clarification.
No problem.
Andrea, does this involve the land itself? Is this one or more of the lots are recreated for the container situation that was so delayed because of weather, et cetera? Is that the location we'll be dealing with?
It's similar to that location, yes.
Very good. Any other questions for Alexandria? Okay, thank you.
Chair Henry, your mic is muted. There we go.
Yeah, thank you. Moving on to the consent agenda, do any of the commissioners have any comments or want to pull any items for discussion? Okay, I'll entertain a motion then.
Motion to approve the consent agenda.
I'll second that motion.
Moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Commissioner Villacana?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
Commissioner Moultrie?
Yes.
Commissioner Simpson-Spearman?
Yes.
And Chairman Henry?
Yes. Okay, the consent agenda has passed, and then we'll now move on to the AB 361 resolution. Alexandria, would you give us your view on where we're at?
Hello again, commissioners. So for on your agenda today is consideration of a resolution in accordance with AB 361 regarding the continuation of teleconferencing meetings for a period of 30 days. On February 16th, Dr. Penny Bornstein, the county's public health officer, rescinded the order requiring masking in all indoor public places in alignment with the state's masking policy. The state's order requires masking indoor public places for those who are not vaccinated, and for everyone, regardless of vaccination status, in healthcare facilities, schools, childcare, homeless shelters, emergency shelters, corrections facilities, long-term care facilities, and on public transit. The COVID case counts in San Luis Obispo County continue to decline from their peak level in January 2022, and it is anticipated that the Board of Supervisors will resume in-person meetings on March 1st, 2022. Therefore, in accordance with AB 361, your commission needs to adopt a resolution if you intend to continue holding meetings via teleconference for an additional 30 days.
Okay, thank you. Any views from the other commissioners on how we should move forward with this resolution?
I have one question. On the last, on page two, on the last whereas, in the interest of, it says deems necessary to continue to hold meetings by teleconference. It doesn't mention the 30-day increment. Should that be included somewhere? This just leaves it open-ended.
Ben, feel free to jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe that you need to have that in there simply because the AB 361 is limited to 30-day duration. So you couldn't extend it longer than that. You could go shorter, but you couldn't go longer.
Okay. Okay, so where are we going with this? I note that we have our next meeting is on the 10th of March, and it's no hearing items, just our workshop. So I'd be interested to hear commissioners' views on whether this is a good time to gently dip our toes back in the public waters, or do we want to continue to hold meetings virtually?
Chair, if we go ahead and approve the AB 361 for this time, it doesn't mean that we can't meet in person for that March 10th meeting, correct? It just gives us the ability to do either.
That's correct, but at some stage prior to that, we'd have to find a way to make that determination.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that process for that is, Alexandria. So the scenario is that we approve the resolution to reserve the ability to meet virtually, but we decide between now and the 10th of March that no, we'd like to have that meeting in public. How does that decision get made and communicated outside the meeting process?
I think it would need to be communicated in this meeting. And so we talked about this a little bit during your last public hearing, where if your commission wanted to adopt the resolution so that you have the option of in-person versus teleconference, one thing that you could do would be to simply state that, you know, your March 10th meeting isn't anticipated to be held in person unless you can list parameters, unless, you know, case count increases or some type of metric that you want for staff to be able to utilize whether or not that's going to be an in-person versus a teleconferencing meeting. That would be one suggestion. The only thing that I would caution, and Ben, please feel free to chime in, is if you're adopting a resolution that you are going to continue teleconferencing meetings, your resolution, the findings that go along with that is that there is essentially danger in holding in-person meetings. And so if your commission's not feeling that that danger exists right now, then it may not be appropriate to make those findings at this time. But Ben, please feel free to chime in.
Yeah, this is Ben North, County Council. And it's tough because things change so quickly, and this is a 30-day period. So I would just kind of echo what Xandria said, that maybe you feel comfortable making the findings today, but by the time the next meeting happens, maybe there are some objective criteria that you can cite that have changed that would allow the planning department to identify that those criteria having been met, we are going to hold the meeting in public. So that would be kind of the approach that I would recommend.
So how are the board dealing with this? They're planning on meeting in early March in person. But how does that, whether we do or don't meet in person or not, get communicated post this meeting? You'd have to set hard criteria that are triggered and would automatically make that the case rather than some other method.
I want to make sure that I'm understanding the question correctly. So for the public and for the commission, essentially the determination as to whether or not you're in person, it's when the agenda is posted. So when the agenda is published, it states the meeting is held via teleconference. And if it's via teleconference, it explains why it's able to be held that way and what the process is for the public to participate in that. If your meeting is held in person, then it just, your agenda states that it's in person and where the location is and how people can participate. So
the scenario could potentially be that we decide we'd like to have an in-person meeting, but if things go back into the danger zone between now and that 72-hour notice period, that the agenda would reflect the fact that we meet telephonic or virtually. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
That's
pretty tricky. Let's see, if you wanted to have that option, we would need to have some, like Ben and I were saying, some metrics now. So just as an option. So maybe your metric is that case counts increase by X percent or something like that, or some type of trigger by a certain date. So let's say if it's maybe, you know, case counts increase by, you know, 10%, 25% starting, you know, by March 1st or by something like that, then that way staff can look at that and say, hey, we had case counts increase. This was the trigger to hold teleconferencing meetings. Therefore, when we publish the agenda, it will be a teleconference meeting on the 10th instead of an in-person meeting. If that isn't triggered, then you could have an in-person meeting. So those would be the type of direction that I think staff would need from your commission. The other option, and I think Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you could allow your meeting to lapse, allow your resolution to lapse. And if for some reason there was concern when you're meeting on the 10th that needed to be a teleconference meeting, you could take action on that resolution at the very start of that meeting. Ben, am I correct on that?
Yeah, that is an option. Yeah, the one kind of caveat to that is that you would have to make the findings of that meeting in order to continue it once it's noticed as a virtual meeting, but that would be an option.
Okay, thank you.
The question, Xander or Ben, are these purview workshop meetings open to the public?
Sure.
Yes, yes.
They are, okay.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Alex.
Oh, I was just going to ask, are these metrics, does the Board of Supervisors actually have these metrics in place already so we don't have to reinvent the wheel here? Is it something that we can just copy what they're doing? If they're planning to meet the first, they must have some sort of metrics already in place.
Ben, I'm not 100% which ones they're using. My understanding is that they're going primarily based off of what the public health officer's recommendation is. And I don't know how that is being specifically communicated to the board. I don't know if that's, via discussions that the board's having with the public health officer, or just once that report's released. So when I was doing my presentation, I was citing the most recent public health officer report, which was February 16th. I don't know the timing of the next one. So I don't know specifically the metrics that the board are using at this time to determine whether or not, but I do know that they were... The previous one, when they went back to doing teleconferencing meetings, it was purely based off of the recommendation of the public health officer at that time, because case counts had risen above what they had ever been during the entire time of the pandemic.
I wonder if people would be, I guess I should have raised my hand, I'm sorry. I wonder if people would be open to this idea that at our March 10th meeting, which is fundamentally a workshop, right? That's the only thing. I don't expect a lot of public to show up for our workshop. So the likelihood that a bunch of people are going to be forced into close contact with each other is pretty low. So I would suggest that we meet in person on the 10th and that we agendize, though, the resolution. So that if things do change between now and then, at that meeting, we could go back to Zoom if we really had to. I'm certainly hopeful that that's not the case. But it would be on the agenda. It would give us the opportunity at that time, if circumstances change, to go back to Zoom. But we could try on the 10th to meet in person. I think the board's done it. I think it's time for us to give it a try. Especially on a low interest, I mean, to the public, I'm sure it's very interesting to us, but low interest to the public meeting.
Mr. Spearman, how do you feel about the meeting in person again?
I agree with Mike. I think it's a low risk time to test out our ability to meet together. And it still provides an opportunity for the public to comment if they wish. And then having it on the agenda gives us that flexibility based off of what the county health department findings are. So it makes perfect sense to me. Alex, do you agree too?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that plan of action. So
sounds like a good plan.
I could ask one other thing, too, is that when you bring the resolution on the agenda to us next time, Xandria, if there are, these objective criteria.
Include that.
If you could include that so that we're not, figuring it out on the fly, but that we have something to go with, But I hope that this is a time where we can start to begin meeting in person again.
It sounds like we have consensus on that. So with that, do we let the current resolution lapse and take no action on this agenda item today? Is that what we do? How do we formalize this?
If we take no action, is that right, Xander?
That is correct.
So we don't need a motion for that?
You do not. No, the resolution automatically will expire 30 days from when you took your last action. So that expiration occurs before your March 10th meeting. And so, yes, there's no action that you would need to take if you want to allow it to lapse.
Okay, very good. So with that, then, I hear that we will be meeting in person at the board chambers on the 10th of March, to which I look forward with great delight. Some of you have never met in person. Are there any comments from staff, Xandria, in terms of what you need from the commission or to facilitate this? Everything is go on your end, and also Ramona.
We will be prepared. And what I will do is on that agenda, we will also include a resolution in there in case your commission wants to take this item back up.
Very good. And do we have any comments from the clerk, Ramona? Do you have anything to add?
I do not. However, Commissioner Villicana does.
I'm missing. Oh, there's a hand there. Sorry, Alex. Yeah.
just a comment here. I guess because February is a short month, technically we'd be under the resolution of the February 10th meeting anyway, wouldn't we? I mean, it's a 30-day.
But all that does is give us the option to go Zoom. It doesn't require us to go Zoom.
Yeah, I know that's what I'm saying.
But I think what Commissioner Villicana is saying is that actually your resolution that you're under right now would carry you probably through March 12th.
But we still need it agendized for the 10th if we're going to extend it.
Correct.
Okay. Right, and it's water under the bridge regarding the 30 days because we've already decided we're not going to call that option in. So, yeah, thanks for that.
Saying, we can do it at the end of the meeting. It doesn't have to be at the beginning of the meeting.
That is correct. That's right. That is correct.
That's right. Anytime. Okay.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you, everybody, for your input, and look forward to that happening. All right. So I think that draws to close the current set of commission business, and we'll move on to our first hearing item. Before we get started, is there any ex parte on the part of commissioners for our hearing item?
Nothing. I've conversed here just within the last week or so with the general manager of all the Hearst things going on, and I'm very familiar with the area where the site's going to go.
Okay, and I guess I should have had that hearing item introduced first before I called for that ex parte. Madam Clerk, could you please introduce the first hearing item?
Hearing to consider a request by Hearst Holdings Incorporated to amend the official maps, part 3 of the coastal land use element. County file number... I have no county file.
2020-0003.
Thank you. Project Manager Jennifer Gutschow.
Okay, thank you for that. Any further ex parte? Okay, let's see. I call for public comment after the presentation. Is that right? I've got lost my place here. Help me out, Madam Clerk.
Yes.
Okay, very good. So, Ms. Gutschow, would you please go ahead with your presentation? Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Henry and Planning Commissioners. I'm going to go ahead and start sharing my presentation. And today we're going to be reviewing the Hearst Holdings LLC General Plan Amendment, as Ramona described. And... the project description for this is to amend the official map, part 3 of the coastal land use element, to change the land use category on 4.98 acres from agricultural to residential rural for the future development of a private cemetery. And also to amend the North Coast Area Plan to establish a planning area standard that limits allowable uses and establishing development standards and permit requirements for the project site. Now, before we get into the analysis of the project, I wanted to take a step back and just clarify some misunderstandings or incorrect information that was put in the staff report. And that is to give you some context of exactly the area we're talking about here. So the first slide here will show you that the Hearst Ranch is actually 83,000 acres. And you can see it here outlined in the purple. The next slide I'm going to show you is the parcel that we identify as the assessor's parcel number where the project is located. Again, this is, if you see, this parcel is smaller, only 23,000 acres, versus the 83,000 acres. That's part of the Hearst Ranch. So Hearst Ranch is one thing here. And then within the Hearst Ranch, there's a parcel. There's actually 200 parcels in the Hearst Ranch. But this is one of the larger parcels that's 23,000 acres. Within that is a small project area of 4.9 acres here. And then the Hearst Castle is outside of the parcel area, but still within the Hearst Ranch area. And that is just to give you an idea of its location next to the project area for the cemetery. So I'll continue through my presentation and you will see this will become a little more clear as well. So my next slide is just to give you an overview of the change of the land use category of the 4.98 acre site on a 23,200 acre parcel within the 83,000 acre Hearst Ranch. And that 4.98 acre site is being proposed to be changed from agriculture to residential rural. And that land use category of residential rural will allow for a private cemetery. The proposed land use category change and the private cemetery is consistent with the California Rangeland Trust conservation easement, which holds the 83,000 acre ranch. The future development of the 4.98 acre site will require a development plan and coastal development permit approval. Excuse me. This process started in September of 2020 by the Board of Authorization, Board of Supervisors starting their authorization. The Planning Commission is hearing it today. It will then go before the Board of Supervisors again on April 19th for a hearing, and that action will be taken to the California Coastal Commission. This is a vicinity map that shows you that the property is approximately 3 miles north of Highway 1 and about a half mile from the Hearst Castle. The land use category is currently agriculture, and you can see all the land around it is agriculture except for the parcel where the area where the Hearst Castle is located, which is a recreation area. And here you can see a zoomed in site plan for the actual project. Again, it's a 4.9 acre site, and that is identified in the yellow hatch marks. And then the parcel line, as you can see, that's the parcel that I just identified. The 23,000 acres is going to be on the upward side of that black dotted line. The potential burial area is 2.5 acres, and that's I delineated in the red line. And it's also accessed via a private access road of Hearst Castle Road and then another private access road. Now, since this property is part of the North Coast Area Plan, we are proposing that we develop some limitations on the change of the residential rural zone for land use development, land use category. And that limitation includes that the uses are limited to private family cemetery, passive recreation, and crop production and grazing. The development shall not be visible from Highway 1, and the development plan approval, development plan is required for the future uses. And this would be the planning area standard that would be added to the North Coast Area Plan. And then the property is also within the coastal zone, so our analysis includes a determination of consistency with the local coastal plan. And that includes that agriculture, the allowed uses are limited to private cemetery, passive recreation, and grazing. The area of interment is less than 3 acres on the 83,000-acre ranch. The proposed use is consistent with the California Rangeland Trust conservation easement, and the site has not been historically used for grazing, nor does it have prime soils. For visual resources, again, the planning area standard will require that the development is not visible from Highway 1. And in biological resources, the area of disturbance consists primarily of non-native grasses and trees, no grading or site improvements proposed other than wrought iron fence and identifying monuments. For cultural resources, there was a surface phase one and an extended phase one subsurface cultural resource study that was provided to the tribes for consultation via per Senate Bill 18. And based on the both of those surface and subsurface studies, the tribes concluded that no further action was required, and they did close consultation. And with that, the recommendation to the Board of Supervisors is to approve the amendments, the official maps, Part 3 of the coastal land use and circulation element to change land use category from agriculture to residential rural on a 4.98-acre parcel of the Hearst Ranch property and to amend the North Coast Area Plan to establish a planning area standard limiting allowable uses and establishing development standards and permit requirements for the project site. I'm available to answer any questions, as is the applicant's representative, Mr. Carmel. Thank you, and that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Are there any questions or clarifications for staff from the commission? I see your hand raised, Commissioner Moultrie.
Well, thank you. Jennifer, with this amendment, a development plan will be required. Will a CDP be required?
Yes.
And can those be handled by staff, or does that have to come to the Planning Commission? Will those have to come to the Planning Commission?
I will ask Alan to clarify, but I believe it comes to the Planning Commission.
Yeah, that's correct. So a development plan goes to the Planning Commission for review.
Okay. I was hoping there'd be a simpler process, but I guess we're going to have
to. Yeah, get it complicated.
Yeah, get rid of it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further questions of staff? Okay, seeing none, does the applicant have a presentation?
Gina has her hand up, Phil. It's hard to see her hand, but it's there.
I missed you.
No problem. Hey, I just wanted to kind of follow up with Mike's question. Is it normally so onerous a process if they just want to do a private family cemetery, that it requires a development plan? Is there, can you explain that?
So right now, Title 23, our Coastal Land Use Ordinance, does require a development plan, you know, Planning Commission review and approval of a proposed cemetery. The one possible option we could consider is, since we're also asking the commission to review a proposed plan area standard, you could recommend that the plan area standard call out a minor use permit as the permit level for this particular site or a cemetery.
And Arlen, if we were to do that, if it, and it still needs a CDP, can that still be handled by staff in conjunction with the minor use permit?
Correct. So it could be a minor use permit / coastal development permit that could go to a hearing officer instead of the Planning Commission, and it would still be appealable to the board.
I would really recommend that to my fellow commissioners, to kind of ease the process for the applicant due to the end goal of the applicant. But let's see what you think.
This item actually was put on the agenda some time ago and then pulled. And I'm not quite sure why that happened, but I agree with streamlining the process. Commissioner Campbell, you've been out there.
I probably watered my horse right by that spot. But anyway, this gets out of control when you start talking like this from my point of view.
So,
okay, it looks like you froze there, Don. So we'll deal with that comment.
Yeah, 3,000 acres and 4 acres for another. I'll tell you a story right now, rather than a discussion. I had the honor with three cattleman friends of mine to get a big tour of the Parker Ranch in Hawaii, and by the general manager of the whole outfit. And what impressed me is a wonderful, beautiful ranch. Similar situation to this, a historical, very large property. But what stuck out in me with a very special thing was about 400 yards from the old house and some of the improvements was a family cemetery. And you got to go and walk by and see the tomb of the grave of the man that started the whole thing eons back. Of course, they had it at the time. What'll happen with this one, the later relatives will be here, but not the originals, probably. But anyway, that meant a lot to me, and it really helped put the whole thing together for a historic ranch.
Yeah, I've been to the Dairy Barn for a number of charitable events, and as well as the airfield, which it's a huge property. So I guess the question for staff is, how do we make this happen so that the applicant doesn't have to come back to us later in the year?
Well, before we do that, maybe we should open the public hearing, make sure there's nobody who needs to speak to this, and then we can talk about the logistics. And meanwhile, maybe Erlyn, you and Jennifer can think about how we would amend that.
Okay, so before, I guess I asked before I get ahead of myself, Jennifer, does the applicant wish to say anything?
Chair Henry, we do have Tim Carmel that's joined the meeting, and I believe his line has been unmuted. Thank you, Mr. Carmel.
Mr. Carmel, good morning.
Good morning. I don't have a formal presentation. I do have just a few short remarks. Good morning, Honorable Commissioners. My name is Tim Carmel. I've been assisting the Hearst family with this project for several years. It's an extremely important project to the family. We started the project in 2018 and filed the application in February of 2020, so it's actually been a very long road to get here. As you've heard, the project site's about 5 acres, 2.5 of which will be used for burials. Comprehensive extended phase one archaeological study and testing was performed by Applied Earthworks, which came up clean, as did a biological resources assessment by Wolf Environmental. There'll be no site improvements with the exception of a fence, no grading, no vegetation removal. The site will be left in its natural state. It's a truly passive project, the most passive of projects. Excuse me. So we ask that you recommend approval of the amendment to the Board of Supervisors. And the idea of a minor use permit in the planning area standards is a wonderful thought. Certainly would appreciate that. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. Ben Higgins, the Director of Agricultural Operations for the ranch, is also here if you have any questions in that area. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carmel. Are there any questions for the applicant from the commission? Okay, I think then with that, we'll open it up for public comment. Any comment for this item? Madam Clerk, would you please check?
Yes, thank you, Chair Henry. At this time, if there is any member of the public that wishes to speak on this hearing item, please use the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen or by pressing *9. And I'll just give it a second here. Chair Henry, no requests to speak have been received.
Okay, thank you. So I'll close public comment and bring it back to the commission for any further discussion at this time.
I see Erlyn just popped up. Is there an easy way for us to make the recommendation to the board and get this to a minor use permit instead of a development plan?
Yes, it's pretty straightforward. The commission's, you know, action on this item will be in the form of a recommendation to the board. So you can just recommend that the permit level in the plenary standard is a minor use permit, and then we'll take that planning commission recommendation to the board for consideration.
So the suggestion, so to do that, I don't know how we would do this procedurally. My suggestion would be for us to go ahead and I don't know what the correct term is, just defer this until later on in the meeting so that you have time to prepare that language. We can do our workshop and then towards the end of that come back and look at your language and make that recommendation and motion for this item. Will that work procedurally?
So
I was going to say, Arlen, since this is just a recommendation, we probably don't need to be so precise with the language. Is that correct?
That's what I was going to say. That's
I'm correct. Sorry.
We have your direction. We will make those changes and present them to the board.
Then, with that, I would move that we recommend to the Board of Supervisors approval of the amendments to the official map of the Part 3 of the Coastal Land Use and Circulation Element to change land use categories from ag to residential rural on a 4.9-acre portion of the Hearst Ranch property. And to amend the North Coast planning plan to establish a planning area standard limiting allowable uses and establishing development standards and permit requirements for the project site. Said permit requirements, we'd recommend be a minor use permit and staff approval. Does that work?
I'll second that motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, perfect. Hearing none, I would call for the vote.
Commissioner Moultrie?
Yes.
Commissioner Campbell?
Yes.
Commissioner Villicana?
Yes.
Commissioner Simpson-Spearman?
Yes.
And Chairman Henry?
Yes, and thank you to my fellow commissioners and staff for easing the path for the applicant. So
thank you.
Appreciate that.
Very good. With that, we will move on to our next item on the agenda. Madam Clerk, would you please introduce that?
Item number six is commission business, and the Planning Commission is going to hold a two-part purview workshop to review the Planning and Building Department priorities for 2022 and all applicable processes, procedures, ordinances, and state laws. Our presenter today will be Exandria Fowler, the Planning and Building Department's Environmental Coordinator.
Morning, Chair Henry and Commissioners. It's Andrea Fowler, representing Planning and Building Department. And
Exandria, I see that Commissioner Villacana, it's hard to see his hand because the background's kind of yellow, but he has his hand up.
Commissioner Villacana, I'm going to get to your recusal part. no problem. So the purpose of this workshop is to provide your commission with an opportunity to review the applicable processes, procedures, and legislative documents that govern the land use entitlement process and to identify any improvements or recommendations that you have to ensure process consistency. And so your workshop is going to be broken down into two parts. Part one is today, and part two will be on March 10th. And part one today will be, we have a couple of different presenters that will be presenting information to you. It's going to be structured in three segments. The first segment is going to cover Williamson Act rules and ordinance cleanup, which is part of the board priorities. That's going to be covered by Kylie Hensley and Jennifer Gutschow. And then the second part of the workshop presentation is going to be getting into all of the rest of the 2022 Planning and Building Department priorities and direction received from the Board of Supervisors. Erlyn Singwald is going to cover that portion of the presentation. And then lastly, we have segmented out the discussion about the distilleries ordinance to the very last topic that will be discussed today, so that Commissioner Villacana will only need to recuse himself from that portion of the discussion and can participate fully in everything else. And so if the commission doesn't have any objections to that, with that, I'd like to turn it over to Kylie and Jennifer to get started on their overview of the Williamson Act rules and ordinance cleanup.
Thank you, Exandria. Kylie Hensley, County Planning Staff. So I'm going to share a presentation. Can you all see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So today I'll be presenting an overview of the Williamson Act review process for new development applications as requested by your commission at your last meeting. So just focusing on review of new development applications as requested rather than discussing the rules of procedure streamlining that we discussed at your last meeting. So starting with some background information about the Williamson Act, the program was established according to the State Land Conservation Act of 1965 and is administered according to our local rules of procedure, which are available at the website link shown on the slide. The purpose of the program is to conserve agricultural lands, open space, and recreational lands to protect from urbanization. And there are over 700,000.
Please excuse the interruption. If you wouldn't mind to please speak up your voice level for the audio. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Ramona. Is that better? Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay. So starting with background information about Williamson Act, the purpose of the program is to conserve agricultural lands, open space, and recreational lands to protect from urbanization. And there are over 790,000 acres under contract countywide. Here's a map showing the properties that are currently enrolled in a Williamson Act contract, shown in the green hatch. Landowners may enter the program by establishing an agricultural preserve and entering into a land conservation contract with the county, which is a 10 or 20 year commitment and provides the property owner with a reduced tax rate in exchange for maintaining their lands in either active agricultural production or open or recreational space. The contract has an annual auto-renewal for a 10-year term, and landowners or the county may file to stop that auto-non-renewal of their contract and allow their contract to expire. And allowed new development for land under contract is limited to compatible uses that are specified in the local rules of procedure. So now that we're done with background, today I'll first start by reviewing the application review process, then discuss some common application types subject to Williamson Act review for new development, go over the application review criteria, and then walk you through a decision matrix of typical recommendations coming from the review. So first, an overview of the application review process. So new applications are received for development. Conditional use permits are the types of applications that will come to Planning Commission. Once the application is received and if it's on Williamson Act land, the first step is staff review and recommendation. Then certain project types require recommendation from the Agricultural Preserve Review Committee, and they make their recommendation to your Planning Commission. The specific project types that require APRC recommendation are listed here in this slide in the gray box. The most common types are non-soil dependent agriculture, cannabis cultivation, and cannabis nurseries, as well as rural recreation and camping. And after the APRC recommendation, the project application will go to your Planning Commission for review and final action. And now moving on to common application types. So compatible uses that require APRC review, as I said, are those non-soil dependent cannabis cultivation and nurseries and incidental camping. And then some common application types that do not require APRC review are soil dependent cannabis cultivation and nurseries and wineries and other ag processing facilities. And now going over the application review criteria. So when we receive a new conditional use permit on contracted land, first we look to see if the property where the new development is being proposed, if it's compliant with its land conservation contract. So the types of questions we ask, is there enough acreage remaining under the contract and still under common ownership? Has the property been sold off through the years and fragmented? Is there a continuation of the original qualifying use or an intensification to a new use? So we look to see if it's an agricultural contract. Is there still active agricultural production on site on the appropriate soils? Or if it's an open space or recreational contract, are those resources still intact? Next, we look and see if the proposed new development is a compatible use as outlined in the Rules of Procedure Table 2. So a small excerpt of this table is shown here on the screen for reference. The full table listed in the Rules of Procedure is many pages and includes many use groups. As you can see, the headings, the table is sorted by use group, and then whether or not that use is compatible with the Williamson Act program in the inland area and in the coastal zone on prime soil and in the coastal zone on non-prime soil. And as an example here, the cannabis activities use group is listed, looking at indoor cultivation that is non-soil dependent. For example, this use would be considered compatible and allowed in the inland area and in the coastal zone on non-prime soils, but it would not be compatible in the coastal zone on prime soils. And that note four that's indicated in the table indicates that APRC review would be required for this project. And the final set of criteria is looking at compatibility principles that are outlined in the rules of procedure. So we ask if the proposed development is consistent with these three principles. Number one, the long-term agricultural productivity of on-site and off-site contracted parcels will not be significantly compromised by the use. Number two, agricultural operations of on-site and off-site contracted parcels will not be displaced by the use. And number three, significant removal of contracted acreage as well as non-contracted land from agricultural open space use or agricultural production will not result from the use. Now moving on to our decision matrix. So as staff and APRC are reviewing the project and the contract requirements and making the recommendations, if we can answer yes to all of these three questions based on the criteria we just discussed, then we would recommend approval of the project at the staff level, and then APRC would review and make the recommendation to your commission as well. So first, if the property was compliant with the contract, if the proposed use is listed as compatible in Table 2, and if the proposed project is consistent with those three compatibility principles, then we would recommend approval. Not all projects are that simple, however. If the property is not compliant with the contract, then we could recommend approval of the project with conditions to require the property to come back into compliance with the contract or to file for contract non-renewal. So an example would be conditioning the project to reestablish an agricultural use if the parcel sizes are correct, but the agricultural use had lapsed. So that could be a condition, or we could condition to amend the contract to reduce the required minimum ownership size to reflect the current ownership structure, or file for non-renewal if coming back into compliance with the contract is not possible. Or we could recommend denial of the project until the property is no longer under a land conservation contract. So applicants could file for contract non-renewal and wait for the remaining term on their contract to expire and then resubmit their development application at that time. If the proposed development was listed as an incompatible use, so not compatible per Table 2 in the Rules of Procedure, we would recommend denial of the project until the property is no longer under contract. And finally, if the project as proposed was inconsistent with any of those three compatibility principles, we could either recommend denial if it seemed like there weren't any possible changes to make to the project to make it consistent, or we could recommend approval of the project with conditions to ensure consistency with those three principles. Example conditions could be requiring additional setbacks to protect off-site agriculture or to relocate the project on site to not displace current agricultural production or interfere with current agricultural operations. And with that, that concludes my overview. And Jen and I are available to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hensley. Before we do that, can I ask that you work with the clerk to make your presentation available to the commissioners? I'd like to benefit from reviewing that, if you could do that, please.
Yes, definitely.
Very good. Christina, I see you have your hand up.
Thank you very much, Chair. Kylie, just a couple of questions. The first one, when you said enough acreage, what is enough in terms of your...
Yes, so that is a complex question a lot of the time. So the program has been in place since the 70s, and a lot of the contracts that we come across are very old, and our rules of procedure have changed through the years. So there's often quite a bit of research that staff has to do to answer that question. The minimum acreage requirements are based on how the property is qualifying for their land conservation contract. Most of the contracts that we see are qualified based on agricultural use. And generally, the rule of thumb is the more intensive the agricultural use, the smaller the acreage requirement, and the less intensive, the larger acreage requirement. So in the current rules of procedure, if someone is qualifying with, for example, a vineyard, which is kind of the most intensive agricultural use, an irrigated vineyard that's a high-value crop, depending on their soil type, they could meet the requirements if they had 20 acres of irrigated vineyard and 40 acres under common ownership. That would be kind of the smallest. And then for the less intensive, if it was a grazing land property that was qualifying with a grazing land use, we would require 320 acres minimum to be enrolled in the contract and under common ownership, but with at least 100 acres of that being classified as moderately productive rangeland.
Kylie, thank you. That's helpful. The other question I had is you, on one of your slides, you listed incidental camping. Can you talk to me a little bit about that linkage with, like, the rural camping ordinance and what is the alignment there?
So I can speak to that, and Erlyn might jump in because he's more familiar with that board direction that we've received to develop that new ordinance. But basically, in the rules of procedure, rural camping is listed as a use that requires agricultural preserve the APRC to review. So we would just be an extra layer of review for rural camping projects to ensure that they are not interfering with the existing ag on site and off site. And that property that wanted to establish rural camping would need to be compliant with their contract. So if they weren't in compliance with their contract, there would be another kind of layer that they would need to figure out before their project could be approved. And then I'll let Erlyn jump in.
Yes, and Kylie, I was hoping you'd kind of angle that a little bit towards the open space designation versus ag.
So our open space contracts, we don't approve a lot of, we don't process a lot of those. They're kind of infrequent. And it would typically be less onerous to meet the findings because they wouldn't need to prove that they're incidental to the agricultural use. Erlyn, I'll let you jump in.
Thank you, Kylie. So I'm going to go into more detail on this in the second segment of the workshop when I talk about the rural camping ordinance. In short, we currently have an ordinance that allows for rural recreation and camping or incidental camping. However, the way that ordinance is currently structured, it doesn't allow for a lot of the types of private campgrounds that have popped up across the county. So the board direction was to look at our current rural recreation and camping ordinance and see where we could make tweaks that could be more conducive to the types of uses that we're currently seeing in the county.
Thank you. I think the point I was trying to make here with staff is when you're taking a look at incidental camping, particularly with open space or recreational, when it comes to the Williamson Act, to ensure that there's a connectivity or a linkage in terms of Erlin and what you're looking to do to move forward, you know, a rural camping ordinance, that there's consistency. And then in one area, it says one thing, and then the other area, it says the other. So it's complicated. It complicates things when it doesn't need to. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christina. Commissioner Campbell, you had your hand raised. You're muted, Don. Don, you're muted.
Don, you're muted.
I'm still very unclear about I saw in your presentation, every other line had two or three cannabis stuff on them. And, you know, I understand marijuana grows from the earth, but how do you handle a situation where it may not even be 20 acres left? It's a lease situation. The cannabis grow under the planning, under this situation, major fences for, you know, solid fences, two-story buildings. It doesn't look anywhere near ag to me. What's the limitation on how far you go? I can understand letting them grow with marijuana out in the field, but when it turns into an industrial plant in the middle of an ag reserve, how do you explain that? And incidentally, this place did not come before the Planning Commission. We never heard about it. Went before a hearing officer.
Are you thinking of a particular project or?
Yeah, I'll tell you exactly where it is. It's at 630 El Pomar Drive, and it's stinking up the atmosphere clear to Templeton.
So we can look into that specific property and maybe follow up with you offline or at a future meeting.
And the reason I'm concerned about it, I live 7 miles from it, but the reason I'm concerned about it is that I know the owner of the property, and you'll remember we went through a little fiasco when that particular owner, I won't mention his name, put electrical situation, or leased the property for solar electrical production against the, and that's certainly not in the ag preserve, I'm quite certain. So if that unit was breached or that ag preserve contract was breached when that person did that, and then turned around and leased more land for this cannabis thing that looks more industrial than it does ag, where does this kind of stuff stop?
So the current rules of the procedure for Williamson Act currently list small-scale renewable energy generation as a compatible use.
To sell to people? To tie in with PG&E and sell it?
Yes.
On an ag preserve property?
Yes.
I'll be darned.
But that being said, the proposed use needs to meet those three principles of compatibility. So the project needs to demonstrate that it's not displacing any on-site or off-site ag and that it's not interfering with existing ag operations. The agricultural use should be protected and not be negatively impacted by that new development, whether it is, you know, small scale solar production. Excuse me.
This is large scale. It's probably 15 acres. You can't farm it anymore because it's all solar.
Ben, I see that you made yourself visible. Would you like to weigh in?
Yeah, I was just going to chime in. So with both cannabis and with electrical production, the Williamson Act does allow electrical production. The idea is that it shouldn't interfere with the qualifying use. So the property should be able to maintain the acreage that it was needed to in order to qualify for the Williamson Act contract. And I'm not familiar with the specific project, so I can't really provide any kind of input specific to it, but that's the idea with both of those, is that these are compatible uses. In order to have a compatible use, you must first have a qualifying use, and you need to maintain that qualifying use.
Well, yeah, as long as I've been in the commission, we have run into this very often, where there was maybe 1,500, 2,000 acres in the ag preserve, and they came and wanted to put up, some things for their own use, et cetera. But this is an industrial operation connected to PG&E right across the street, and you couldn't farm an inch of it if you wanted to.
So again, we're not familiar with that specific project. The staff on this call involved in the review of that application, but we can look into that and follow up.
It could be that
if there isn't the qualifying use on site anymore, if there's no agriculture, it may be that either of those projects, one of the conditions for approval required the landowner to non-renew their contract. So it could be that they filed for non-renewal and have already started paying their increased property taxes, and the contract is in the process of expiring. That could be what happened.
Okay. Well, it didn't happen. It would be a continuum from now, I would think, because 10 years hasn't gone by.
Yes, but I'm saying as a condition for approval for either that solar project or the cannabis project, the department could have required that non-renewal process to start and that 10-year countdown to start before the project was approved. That's typically what we see for non-compliant properties.
And Kylie,
you allow it.
We need to probably do more research for you and find out exactly what's happening with this property. Like Kylie mentioned, there's just a lot of research that goes into whenever we have an inquiry. And since we're not really prepared to respond to you on this question.
I wanted to talk. Yeah, I used an example, and I wanted to just get a general view of what this looked like. I mean, I understand the situation. If they want to pull the pin and go 10 years before they do this thing to it, whatever it might be, I can understand that. But I don't think in this one that was the case. They built all this stuff long before a 10-year, was up.
But sometimes if the proposed use is identified as compatible, even if there isn't existing agriculture on site, we would allow that use because it's technically compatible with the contract. And it's kind of on a case-by-case basis. And
things have changed considerably with that contract.
Yeah.
Over
kind
time.
Of speculative at this point for us to respond. And,
I don't want to take any more of your time.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Campbell.
Quick question.
Alex, you have your hand up, Alex.
Yeah, just a little clarification on what Don was talking about. So if it's if the project isn't approved for Williams and I contract piece of property and they file for non-renewal, can they basically, it's going to take 10 years to non-renew, can they move forward with the project before that non-renewal is actually in place then? So they can actually have a non-compliant project for 9 years under contract if they're in that first year of that renewal?
Then I'll let you answer that question.
Sure. I mean, so if it's a compatible use on a Williams on that contract, I think we have allowed those type of uses to go forward with the project being conditioned to enter into non-renewal. And the rationale behind that is that upon filing the notice of non-renewal, the tax benefits for being in the Williams Penn Act, they decline very rapidly immediately upon filing those. So they lose the benefit of being under contract pretty quickly and penalizing or, however you may look at it, an owner for that or not allowing them to move forward with the use seems punitive, I guess, in light of those facts. And if I could just one more comment. So Commissioner Henry, I just wanted to check in on public comment and make sure that we have a plan for that. I don't know if you want to do it for each of the three segments that Xander outlined or if you want to do it at the end. I just wanted to make sure that I see that we have one member of the public who has their hand raised.
Yeah, I was going to ask that question because I can see us, you know, running out of time. We're coming up in the morning break here in 15 minutes. And I think the idea to do it section by section is probably a good one. And we can have a couple of stabs at it, I guess. Although I suppose at any stage somebody could ask a question or make a comment on something that happened earlier. It doesn't have to preclude that, I don't think, does it?
Yeah, it's totally your prerogative in terms of how you want to do it. If you want to have, there aren't a large number of people that are participating. So if you want to have it a little bit more free flowing, that's totally at your discretion.
I think the whole idea when I raised this idea last year was to have a dialogue of, you know, similar to what Commissioner Campbell is having with staff, you know, it's part of a learning process. So I would like to, you know, not facilitate it too tightly. So, Alexandra, I see you popped up. Did you have a suggestion here?
Yeah, no, my suggestion was going to be that essentially, since we are breaking it down, the conversation into kind of three parts, to at the when you're feeling like you're kind of wrapping up that, I'll open it up for public comment to see if anyone wants to speak on the particular topic that was just recently discussed. And then if there are comments, take those comments. If you want to have some further discussion about that, you can. Otherwise, then you can move on to the next topic.
Perfect. Okay, that's what we do. I do have a question, Kylie. So let's pretend I have a legacy homestead property, 320 acres. I apply for land conservancy on the qualifying. Let's pretend it's grazing and beekeeping, and that's approved as a use, and that contract is granted. And then subsequently I decide, oh, well, you know, I'd like to have a little bit of rural camping, or I'd like to have a little bit of solar. At that stage, are there, I just missed where there's additional approvals that are required, or that as a landowner, I'm allowed to implement those things if they're an allowed use. How does that adding stuff on later work?
Yes. So if you had maintained your grazing use and you are still compliant with your contract, you would apply for that permit that you need for the new camping. And the only difference from the review process for a property that isn't under contract is that we would look at your Williamson Act, make sure you're consistent with your contract, and then we would just look and go through those three principles of compatibility and make sure that where you were proposing the camping wasn't displacing the grazing operation or interfering with it. And then HRC would also review the project and make those same findings. So it would just add a bit of review time to your application review because it would need to get scheduled for APRC.
Okay, thank you. So, and all that's handled at the staff level. In every case, it would never come to the commission for a determination? Or are there cases where an application might have to come before the commission?
The final review body would be the same. So if that project would normally require a minor use permit, then it wouldn't go to PC. If it required a conditional use permit, then it would go to PC.
Very good. Thank you for that. Are there any more questions on the Williamson Act at this point? I guess we can move into the ordinance cleanup. Is that part of the second part of the first part? Is that right?
I think there's one public comment.
I think someone wants to speak, Phil.
Okay, we can do that. I was just going to finish all of the first part, but okay, so let's do that. Let's call for public comment at this time on the Williamson Act presentation.
Thank you, Chair Henry. At this time, as the chair mentioned, if you have any questions related to the Williamson Act, please use the raise hand feature or any comment. I apologize. If you have any questions, please use the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen or by pressing star 9. So we had a hand raised. It appears username with M Brown. I will unmute your connection and you should receive a notification. It looks like your line has been unmuted and your comments are limited to 3 minutes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Mike Brown. My comments are about the general process here, and I can't comment on each of the segments, but we think that you need to take a step back and use these workshops, or maybe put a new workshop in before the next one, and come out of some of the detail and look at the overarching, both the subject matter, main characteristics of planning and zoning in the county, and then secondly, the characteristics relating to the process and procedures. And there are two distinct realms there. The biggest question for you, and all these other things subsist under this, is that your overarching scheme of land use regulation is based on rationing. The county has about 3,500 square miles of land and a little less than 4%, including the cities and the unincorporated urban places, allow urban development. And that fundamental fact is rationing housing, rationing commercial and other types of development to the detriment of the citizenry. And we think, as the custodians of the general plan, you as the commission need to step back and see if that big overarching policy is still correct. It was essentially adopted and fortified about, 12 years ago or so, under the rubric of smart growth, if you will. And it's time to take a look at that, see if that makes sense and what's the impact on the citizenry. The whole architecture of the general plan, as you know, is very complicated with all the different elements and so forth, and some of them go way beyond what scholars would say should be a good general plan, and are full of absolute operational details and zoning-like concepts. And I would cite the open space and conservation plan as a classic example of that. And so as the custodians of the general plan, we would hope that you would, before you go to that next scheduled session, which again has to do with the priorities of the work of the staff and the budget and which things they're going to work on pretty much, that you interpose another session in there and talk about these big strategic issues receive some data about what's happening in the county and how that affects the substance, and then what to do with the actual process and procedures. Thank you very much, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. I will ask one question. You introduced yourself, but throughout your comment, you were saying we. You didn't say as much, but I'm assuming you're saying we in terms of CoLab. Is that correct?
Oh, Mr. Brown, I'm requesting that you unmute your connection. I'm sorry, I muted you, so you will have to acknowledge my request again.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, I should have said that. I am representing the Coalition of Agriculture, Labor, and Business, and our membership, of course, is very, very involved in many aspects of your work. But I am available to answer any questions. I have extensive experience in my life as a planning director, city manager, county executive officer, and commissioner of a state housing department, and I'm very willing to help you in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your comments.
Thank you. At this time, if there is any member of the public that wishes to speak on this discussion item, please use the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen or by pressing *9. And Chair Henry, no additional requests to speak have been received.
Okay, very good. How long will it take to do the ordinance cleanup presentation, do we think?
So this is Erin Lowenthal, Planning Division Manager. So the next segment is an overview of the Planning and Building Department priorities and long-range planning workload. The staff presentation will be, I would say, about 10 minutes.
So we can take our, why don't we do this? Why don't we take our morning break now for 15 minutes and reconvene at 10:20, if that's okay with the rest of the commissioners, and then you'll be able to continue uninterrupted. Is that okay?
I think you meant 10:40?
Whatever I said, I meant 10:40.
Okay.
Okay, very good. We'll call a recess and we'll reconvene at 10:40. Thank you. Okay, it's 10:40, so if the commission and staff are ready, we can reconvene. Welcome back for the break. So I don't know that we're still in the first part one of three, so I don't think we need to announce anything on this particular one there. And if you want to go ahead with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. I'm Erin Lowenthal, Planning Division Manager for Long Range Planning and Housing. So this segment of the workshop is a presentation on the Planning and Building Department's recent priorities report to the Board of Supervisors. This last round, the priorities report was essentially setting the department's fiscal year 22-23 Long Range Planning work program. This is an annual report we take to the board. This year, the report was in two parts. The first part was on November 16th when we went to the board and got direction on basically confirming our current long-range planning priorities, and then the board gave us a list of additional priority projects they would like us to work on. We then returned to the board for the second part on January 25th. We presented the board with an estimated budget, timeline, and scope for each of the new priority projects they directed us to work on. And based on that information, the board was able to narrow down the priorities that they want us to continue with, and they gave us direction to return with a budget adjustment to allocate resources to those new priority projects. So on November 16th, we divided up the priority workload into mandatory and discretionary. So again, the board confirmed our existing priority projects, and then in terms of new mandatory workload, they added implementing the Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan and implementing Senate Bill 9. We haven't discussed Senate Bill 9 very much with the Planning Commission yet. I imagine most of you are fairly familiar with it. It's a new state law, went to effect January 1st, and it allows for up to four dwellings and lot splits in areas that are zoned for single family dwellings through a ministerial process. So our department will have to amend our land use ordinance and subdivision ordinance to be consistent with that new state law. In terms of additional discretionary workload, this is the list that the board gave us on November 16th. It included the advisory council guidelines, the cannabis program EIR, craft distilleries ordinance, which we're going to separate out as a separate discussion item today, adding guest ranch provisions to the current dude ranch ordinance provisions, a focused update to the cannabis ordinance that would start the 5-year kind of limit or life of a use permit for cannabis activities when operations begin, not when the permit is approved, and then also allowing for ancillary distribution in agricultural and rural lands areas. So that's separate from the cannabis EIR. This is just a more focused cannabis ordinance update. Then implementing the Paso Basin planting ordinance. That is a project that we're currently working on. And if that ordinance is ultimately approved by the board, our department will be asking for additional staff to implement that ordinance. And there's the rural camping ordinance and small urban wineries ordinance. So that was the list they asked us to work on. And then when we went back to the board on January 25th with our actual budget request and cost estimate and scope of work, the board ultimately narrowed down the new priorities for our department to include craft distilleries, which again is going to be a separate item, small urban wineries, and rural camping. I have here on the slide also our proposed timeline for completing each of these ordinances. And I'll use this slide as an opportunity to really clarify for the commission and the public listening. So I think there's some misconceptions out there that, you know, we got this direction from the board and we're starting immediately on these ordinances, and that's not the case. So the timelines for developing these ordinances will begin once the board allocates funding and positions as part of the budget, and then our department is able to hire and train a project manager to manage these work efforts. I'm estimating that these work efforts could begin in about the fall of 2022. Again, assuming resources are allocated as part of the budget. So I'm going to go into a little bit of detail on each of these new priority projects that the board did add. The first is small urban wineries. So mechanically, this is a pretty simple amendment. So right now, our land use ordinance does not allow for wineries in the commercial retail land use category. It does allow for wineries in the commercial service land use category. I think a good example of where that's been successful is Tin City in Templeton, where you have wineries that have kind of ancillary tasting rooms and retail cells. So this would be an amendment to also allow for wineries in commercial retail areas when the winery is incidental to retail use, such as a tasting room or bottle sales. So again, that's a very easy change to make to the ordinance, but it does, I think, raise some important land use compatibility considerations that will have to be considered as we develop the ordinance. And you know, that's because a winery is a industrial type use. It's a manufacturing use. And of course, that type of use can have a lot of impacts on surrounding, you know, retail land uses. You know, there's a lot of truck trips, forklifts, noise. So I think really the key is the word small. It's really defining like what size winery could actually be incidental to a retail use and compatible with the, you know, surrounding retail land uses. So likely this ordinance update effort would involve like a limited case production, you know, maybe 2,500 cases or less. Again, these in smaller scale, and then you know, operational standards to address impacts that a winery, a small winery, could have on adjacent retail uses. The next is the rural camping ordinance. This probably received the most discussion and attention at the Board of Supervisors on hearings on our priorities reports. As I, you know, briefly touched on earlier, the county does have an ordinance already. It's the rural recreation and camping provisions of our land use ordinance that allows small private campgrounds. The problem is with new online platforms like Tip Camp, a lot of small private campgrounds have popped up in the county, and the current ordinance standards just don't work for many of those sites. They're just too restrictive, or whatever reason, they're just not compatible with, they don't allow a path forward for many of these sites. So the direction from the board was to evaluate updating these ordinance provisions that could create a possible path for some of these tip camps to become legalized and get a permit to operate. I think a good way to best understand this ordinance update effort is to kind of consider the current provisions of the recreation and the rural recreation and camping ordinance. So currently, it is limited to organizational camps and seasonal camping as incidental to an agricultural use. So if there is, I'll just say hip camp, that's what everyone's talking about. You know, if there's a hip camp on a agricultural zone site that actually, you know, doesn't have an agricultural use, then the camp clearly isn't going to be incidental to an ag use because there is no ag use on the site. And if there isn't an organizational camp associated with it, it wouldn't be allowed. So that's pretty limiting. Also limited to the agricultural rural lands, land use categories. And then the current ordinance has a minimum site area that's equal to the minimum parcel size for a subdivision. I put an example here, and this also is kind of touching a little bit on Commissioner Spearman's comment earlier, that in terms of consistency with the rules of procedure. So, you know, right now, under this example, an agricultural zone site that doesn't have a more intensive agricultural use, the minimum parcel size would be 320 acres. So that would become the minimum site area for one of these incidental camping uses. And, you know, a lot of sites don't have that acreage. So I'm just briefly here, some possible standards that could be developed as part of a rural camping ordinance. Would include obviously limiting it to certain land use categories, identifying minimum setbacks, having a maximum number of campsites. I think it would be logical to link that to the parcel size, so X number of sites for every X number of acres. Access improvements, of course, you know, fire hazard will be a major consideration in the hip camp or rural camping ordinance. Noise and parking standards, kind of similar to what we have in the vacation rental ordinance now. Enforcement provisions to go along with that. And I think a big consideration is sanitation facilities and just establishing you know, guidelines for the standards that those would have to meet. So the next slide here, this is actually stepping back and looking at the long range. So the previous slides were focused on those new priorities. And now I also just wanted to take this opportunity to give the commission a kind of 6-month outlook for long range planning workload. And not all of these are going to come to the commission, but they'll be going to the board or there'll be workshops. There may be some, you know, community interest. It's definitely good to have this on your radar. So next month, we're going to the Board of Supervisors for a 3-year review of the inclusionary housing ordinance. 3 years ago, Board of Supervisors updated the inclusionary housing ordinance to change the in-lieu fee structure for projects to pay to meet their affordable housing requirement. When the board adopted this revised fee structure, they included this provision that stated essentially the board shall hold a hearing in 3 years to determine if broad-based funding sources have been established for affordable housing, and if so, the board shall repeal the inclusionary housing ordinance. Over the last couple of years, we spent a lot of time investigating other possible broad-based funding options. When I say broad-based funding options, really that was narrowed down to an affordable housing bond. And the idea, you know, behind that was, you know, we heard from the builders, Home Builders Association, but they're the ones actually constructing the housing supply. Why should they be the only ones providing the local funding source for affordable housing? And kind of based on that concern, the board said, yeah, let's look at other funding sources that everyone is pitching in towards. And again, the focus was an affordable housing bond. We were making a lot of progress towards actually putting the bond on the ballot. I think we actually went to the board to discuss that last in February 2020. Then COVID hit, and the feasibility of a housing bond passing, it was already kind of marginal, and the feasibility just is completely eliminated with COVID. So that discussion will kind of resume again on March 15th at the board when we bring this review of the inclusionary housing ordinance. We'll leave some act rules of procedure. We discussed that at your last meeting to streamline the process. We're going to take those amendments to the board on April 19th. Monarch Dunes specific plan amendment. So this is a private new applicant submitted general plan amendment at Trilogy or Monarch Dunes to essentially allow for additional residential development. There's the passive that we anticipate having a community workshop with the HLA and other concerned members of the community in the spring. We're also working on the Paso Basin planting ordinance. Per the board direction, that ordinance it's fairly similar to the current agricultural offset ordinance. However, it would increase the exemption level from 5 acre feet to 25 acre feet. And then also through what we call a tier two permit, allow for water neutral plantings as the current ordinance allows for. We've been working on an environmental impact report for that ordinance, and we anticipate releasing the draft EIR in the spring. Also, very significant development project and specific plan we're working on is the Dana Reserve project. That's about 1,300 new homes just north of Napomo, and about 250,000 square feet of non-residential floor area. We also anticipate releasing that draft EIR in the spring. This is something that will kind of directly impact the Planning Commission because we plan to have a study session at the Planning Commission during the 45-day public review period on the Dana Reserve EIR. We're also going to have a study session with LAFCO and the Local Agency Formation Commission because that project will involve the Napomo CSD annexing the Dana Reserve site into their service area boundary. So it's going to require LAFCO approval, and LAFCO ultimately is going to have to rely on our environmental impact report when they take action to approve an annexation. So we want them plugged in on that process early. Last time I also gave your commission an update on the coastal EDU ordinance and the low specification rental ordinance. As I announced last time, those were both approved by Coastal Commission with suggested modifications. We now have 6 months to bring those suggested modifications back to the board for approval, and we anticipate that will occur in May. Another one that we haven't discussed much with the commission is pre-approved ADU plans. So the county did receive a grant from the state to work with local architects to develop pre-approved ADU plans that public can use kind of off the shelf to submit to construct an ADU. We have released a request for proposals on that, and we anticipate in the summer to have like an initial set of conceptual plans that we'll make available to the public and to the commission. Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan, we are very close to having that finally approved with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the next steps are to develop a memorandum of understanding with a nonprofit. We are currently in talks with the Land Conservancy to be what's called their implementing entity. So they would really be the kind of key, consultant working with the county to help implement the HCP. We're also updating the fee study for the HCP to determine what the cost would be for individual landowners to participate. And we'll need to bring both the MOU and the results of the fee study to the board this summer. Also in the summer, we'll be bringing the planting ordinance to the Planning Commission to review. And then finally, the Avila Community Plan is kind of ramping up again. We were able to hire a new project manager, and we are engaging with the Apple Valley Advisory Council subcommittee on the community plan. And we anticipate by September, we will be releasing a new revised draft plan that addresses many of the comments that we received, and holding a public workshop as well. So that's what you can kind of expect to see from long range planning over the next 6 months. And that concludes my presentation, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Erlyn, for that. I see, Christina, you have your hand up. I'll bet it's about camping. You're muted.
Erlyn, would you mind putting that last slide back up in terms of your 6 month out priorities? Thank you, Erlyn. I had a question for you on the ADU and the Los Osos vacation rentals, since it went to Coastal Commission. Could you please educate me? Based off of their recommendations, then the county planners take a look at that and see if those recommendations would suffice. If they do, then do they go to the board? And then does that pass as final? Is that the correct approach?
Yeah, that's correct. And the May date is our estimated date for taking this back to the board.
So, Erlyn, then does the public have another opportunity to comment in that process? And if so, when?
Yeah, so that will be a public hearing in May. So the public would have an opportunity to comment then during the public hearing at the Board of Supervisors.
Okay. And the Dana Reserve draft that you mentioned with the EIR. The question I had with that is, I believe I heard you say that there was going to be a study. Could you explain that a little bit more to me, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're currently working on the draft environmental impact report, and we'll be releasing it in the next couple months. Once we release the draft environmental impact report, there's a 45-day public review period. This isn't required by CEQA, but because of the level of public interest and just the overall scale of the project, we think it would be helpful to hold a study session with the Planning Commission and also APCO during that 45-day public review period. We think that'll also be helpful for the Commission to just begin to understand the project early on before it actually comes to you for action next year. And so it would just be an opportunity to hear from the public on some of the key comments in the draft EIR, and for the Commission also to give input on your any concerns, or have us answer any questions about the draft EIR.
Erlyn, I really appreciate that. I think that's a great approach to do the study sessions like that with the more complicated projects, especially with such a land mass. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Hey, Erlyn, thanks for the presentation. In the materials that you gave us, that staff gave us ahead of time, one of the items that board seemed to think was a relatively high priority was a review of the community advisory committees and their roles. Am I correct? Is that something you guys are going to be getting to in the next year or so?
So that's something that, you're right, the board gave us direction to add that to our list. But then when we went back to the board in January, that didn't make the cut.
No, it didn't.
Yeah, it was really just those three items: the distilleries, rural camping, and small urban wineries that they directed us to continue working on.
Was the scaled down scope due primarily to budgetary considerations, do you think?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. Because that was one of our items for discussion, was what is the role of the community advisory committees, and so it's disappointing that that's something that won't be addressed. Thank you.
Christina, back to you.
Thank you. I think, Alex, did you have your hand up first? I'll go after you.
Oh, that's all right. Go ahead, Christina.
Okay, on the Avila, on the Avila and the other advisory committees, the one thing I would, or advisory councils, is, I did want to mention that we did get public comment with concern about that as well in our documentation. So I'm wondering, Erlyn, is there a way that we can just provide? I'm sure that many councils have had new members with COVID and other things. You know, it's been 2 years. Is there a way that there could be a training for the advisory councils so they know that their meetings should be open to the public and easily accessible to the public, and that their councils, as the bylaws state, as written by the supervisors, are inclusive to the community in which they represent? You know, can the bylaws be reviewed by the advisory councils so they're, and that a formal recommendations have to be provided to us with a vote? You know, so it seems like there's discrepancy between the advisory councils on how they provide us information and how they conduct their business and how open and inclusive they are. So if there could be some clarity and direction based off of the bylaw that manages them, I think that would be extremely useful. I don't know if that would be that heavy a lift, and I think it would be very helpful so people of the community feel like they're truly represented by the advisory councils that are supposed to be representing them.
Yeah, thank you, for your comment on that. A lot of what you're describing is what was included in that scope of work that we presented to the board, and they chose not to allocate resources. However, I think there's certainly opportunities for the individual liaisons to work with their advisory councils to educate them on their role in the process. For with Avila in particular, I was at their last meeting, and their liaison, Nicole Ellis, did a great job giving them a very high-level overview of all of the plans that affect development in Avila. So I think just through those ongoing conversations, we can use that as an opportunity to educate the advisory councils.
Thank you. Alex?
Yeah, a couple things. One, a question on the Williams Neck rules of procedure. And I know we're looking at doing something to streamline that. Was the streamlined version of the way it works what we looked at when we were talking about workload? Or are we basing it off of the existing kind of way everything goes when you actually, calculated how much time that takes?
Yeah, so really the emphasis of the streamlining was just taking out some kind of redundant levels of review. The current process requires, an amendment to an ag preserve to go through, APRC and then the planning commission and then to the board. Then we have to come back to the board again with the contract. So it was just streamlining that process by just having the APRC as the primary review authority, and not also bringing them to planning commission, so eliminating planning commission from the process, and then being able to accomplish approval of the ag preserves and Williams Neck contract amendments as one board of supervisors hearing item. And of course, that's going to reduce a lot of work for our department to implement the Williams Neck program.
I was trying to clarify that when looking at the staff workload and the full-time employee hours that are required, was the hours that you gave us in the packet based on the existing way we review?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that was based on kind of existing actual data we've spent coding to administering the Williams Neck program. So there could be efficiencies. The whole goal is to create efficiencies by streamlining, so that could slightly reduce the associated workload. Yeah.
Okay. Just want to find that out. And then secondly, on the Paso Basin planting ordinance that's going in, I know there was the public comment period that was passed back in December, I believe it was, or November, December. And I know there was some industry concerns about the ordinance. And so how do those get integrated into the plan? If there's any substantial changes, does it go back for a secondary public comment period, or what is the process? I'm just trying to understand how this all works.
Yeah, good question. So we did release a public review draft of the planting ordinance itself. We got several comments from the community. Some of those comments resulted in some modifications to the ordinance, and that revised version of the ordinance is going to be discussed and released with the draft EIR when it's released.
Okay. So it, will it go back out then for, I mean, if there's any, so there's no secondary public comment period, you just go for the one comment period, and then when it comes before the Planning Commission, if there's any more public comments, it'll be discussed at that point.
Yeah, and during, I mean, really the focus of the public review period for the EIR is to get comments on the EIR, but we expect we're going to get comments on the actual ordinance language and the EIR, and those comments, you know, will be considered in the final EIR and brought forward to the Planning Commission and Board of Supervisors.
Okay, thank you.
There's no other questions. I have one for you, Erlen, and it's regarding the shovel-ready ADU plans pre-approved. So does that, presumably that's to help facilitate, reduce time and expense and all that. Does that look at just planning department approval, or does that give somebody a get-out-of-jail-free card also with building permits?
Well, ADUs are required to be approved through a ministerial process. So the planning review is pretty straightforward, as long as, you know, not in an exclusion area like we're going to have for Cambria and Los Osos if the board approves the coastal modification. So it's really focused on the building plans and having pre-approved plans compliant with the building code to really reduce the plan check time.
Okay, so the permits will get issued a lot more quickly, as you say, ministerially, presumably.
Right, and there'll be at a, you know, lower cost to the applicants, of course, because they won't have to prepare their own plans.
Very good, because right now the entire, you know, permitting pipeline is pretty long, so that's a good thing. Okay, thank you. Any other questions before I see if there's any public comment on this, on the priorities? Hearing none, Madam Clerk, do we have anybody wanting to public comment on this portion of our workshop?
Chairman Henry, at this time we have no pre-recorded messages or any hands raised amongst the attendees.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Christine, I see you're back again. Hi.
I'm sorry, but Erlen, before you leave, I just wanted to ask you just a question in terms of long-term planning, and it had to do with something I had been reading about Santa Barbara County's One Climate Initiative, where they're trying to bring a lot of their planning initiatives under one umbrella and taking a look at the impact of climate change on planning, especially in the area of environmental justice as an element. Can you talk, or, and if I'm not directing this question correctly, just let me know, but I was curious about what discussion is happening in the planning department, and it, in some way, ironically links to probably the comment that Mr. Brown brought up in the beginning, which is the general plan and how that is looked at in as we move towards the future and the different challenges we have in the future. Can you give us some insight in what the thinking is in the planning department on that issue?
I can share kind of my initial thoughts to that, and it might not be the response you want to hear. Like when I was listening to Mr. Brown's comments as well, and your comment about the climate action planning, I think really the opportunity to take that holistic, you know, look at county planning would be through like a comprehensive general plan or at least a land use circulation element update. We have not had a comprehensive land use circulation element update in many decades. I think what Mr. Brown was referring to in his comments earlier was several years ago, the county did add strategic growth principles into the framework for planning document, which is part of our land use element, which provided some high-level guidance emphasizing, you know, development in urbanized areas where there's the infrastructure and resources and services for development. But that was a very kind of focused effort, just adding some policies. I think the real opportunity to relook at our planning kind of model and framework would be through a comprehensive update to the land use circulation element. The challenge, you know, that's challenging for even a city to do, for the county, because we cover such a large area, so many communities, so many stakeholders, so many water purveyors. That would be a major undertaking.
Okay. Thank you. I guess my question was, especially with the three laws that have now been passed with nine, and then you're taking a look at a different way that you're going to be calculating vehicles as well. I mean, these changes, I take it they're just going to be, I was wondering if it would have been a broader view when you're incorporating these, but I take it that based off of the size and scale, you're going to just be more of a as they come approach.
Yeah, and also the other I think part of the response is, you know, the county's approach has been to really accomplish this on a community plan level. So when we update the Avila community plan, that's updating the land use and circulation element for Avila. We recently updated the plan for Los Osos, for San Miguel, for Shandon. So we really do it on a community by community level because that's more manageable. And I think with the Avila community plan update, like we've discussed before, there is an opportunity to address sea level rise and climate change as part of that process. Also for the Avila community plan and most community plans, we prepare an environmental impact report, which will also need to look at climate change and sea level rise. So there's that opportunity.
Then the question then would be, when I took a look at your housing documents, there were projections for, moderate income, below moderate income, higher moderate income, and those projections going out now in six years, you need to hit your mark. So the question I have, since it doesn't look like that will be hit, how do you really determine that as a county you're hitting your affordable housing objectives when you're doing everything by a community plan and it's separated? I'm trying to understand how housing is projected, especially affordable housing. And, affordable housing, if you're taking a median income of 81 in SLO County, you're looking at, a $200,000 to $350,000 home, which, I'm just wondering how we're getting to where we're trying to go in terms of our housing goals when from a policy perspective, everything is done not as under one umbrella.
Yeah, I think that is a great comment. And again, as we update community plans, I think that's an opportunity to look at land use changes that will help us meet those housing element goals. You mentioned the housing unit targets and the housing element. We do plan to achieve those a large part through ADU development, because we did a market study that showed that ADUs actually tend to be affordable at the low and moderate income level. So a major part of our plan is to meet that goal through ADU development. And I wouldn't say yet that we're not going to be able to meet those targets. I think they could be realistic. And as we update individual community plans, I think it's a great thought that we need to give a lot of emphasis on how, with each community, we can kind of move the needle to meet those goals and be consistent with the housing element through, land use changes, higher densities, et cetera. One other kind of caveat I probably should mention is just the way housing element law is structured. When we get those housing unit production numbers from the state, we have to show that there are enough areas that have the current existing zoning to meet those targets. So if we have a plan to redesignate areas to residential or increase densities, we can't get credit for that because that's not the existing zoning that's in place today. But it really would help us prepare for the next housing element cycle if we have our community plans that have a vision for more housing and more residential land use categories in the future.
Thank you, Erlyn.
So I guess just to follow up to that then, Erlyn, how do you see the overlay of SB 9 helping or not helping the affordable housing targets? It would seem to me that, you're looking at more density in areas that are, traditionally single family residential, and that could help. Is that being factored in?
I think we're still yet to see the impact of of SB 9. It's been in effect a couple months now. We haven't received an overwhelming, level of public interest in that. We do get, periodic questions about it. I think kind of like the, ADU ordinance, at the end of the day, we can have a process that streamlines ADU permits, but it's still expensive to build one. Same thing with, SB 9 dwellings. There's still kind of that cost, whether it pencils out for individual landowners to actually build four dwellings on their property. So I think we're just kind of yet to see what the impact will be.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. So let's see, we've had called for public comment and had none on this. Are we finished with the priorities session at this point?
So, Mr. Chair, there is the third segment on distilleries.
Right, that's what I'm asking. So if we're ready to move on to that, and if we are, then I think Alex, you had a conflict there.
Yeah, obviously, due to my business, I'll have to recuse myself from this session of the workshop today.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to you coming back after that for the conclusion of our meeting today. So, yes, I guess with that, we can go. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'll mute and turn off my video. I'll just listen in from the outside.
Perfect. Thank you. Sorry, Michael, I see that you did have your hand up and you just disappeared.
I just took it down.
I'm sorry. Okay. You sure?
Yes, thank you.
All right, very good. Okay, well, with that, let's go ahead and look at the distilleries as our last item of business this morning.
Thank you. So this will be a pretty short presentation on craft distilleries, similar to the approach I took with rural camping and recreation, or rural recreation and camping, it's actually called. I think a good way to describe the need for a distilleries ordinance is by looking at the current process and how it could be modified to be more conducive to folks establishing craft distilleries. So currently there is a process for someone to establish a craft distillery on their property. You would have to go to the food and beverage product manufacturing section of our land use ordinance. And if you go to that, what's called table 2-2, which identifies all the different possible uses and whether they're allowed in the individual zoning districts or land use categories. For the agriculture and rural lands land use categories, you would find this footnote number 11, which states that food, beverage, and product manufacturing is limited to the processing of raw materials or on the site of the processing facility or on adjacent parcels. So this language has been challenging for folks looking to establish a craft distillery because the raw materials are not always grown on site or able to be grown on site or adjacent parcels. Just a little bit of history on this. So there was a time when we didn't have a separate wineries ordinance where if someone wanted to establish a winery, they would be subject to this same requirement. It would be considered food and beverage product manufacturing. But then as the winery industry really started to grow in our county and there was a large kind of glut in the supply of wine grapes being grown and just not enough processing facilities available to turn all those wine grapes into wine. So we crafted a separate kind of carve out just for wineries that would allow a new winery to be established to process offsite wine grapes. So there's an opportunity to do a similar carve-out for craft distilleries where instead of just relying on this food and beverage product section of our ordinance and instead of the processing being limited to raw materials grown on site or adjacent parcels, we could allow for craft distilleries with its own set of standards to address kind of operational impacts, land use compatibility concerns, as one example, with a new product or commodity now able to be, offered in ag and rural land areas of the county that could result in more traffic in rural areas, and that impacts on adjacent lands, increased water demand. So we would need to look at all these impacts and come up with proposed development standards. Those standards could look very similar to what we currently have in place for wineries, or they could look different. We don't really know until we get into the analysis and do our kind of community and stakeholder outreach. So that's my presentation on craft distilleries. And again, like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, because we don't have the staff currently assigned to these new board priorities, it's something that we can talk about high level, conceptually, really interested in the feedback from the commission, but it's not something we're currently working on.
Thank you, Erlen. Don, you have your hand up. You're muted, Don.
So the second one, footnote 11 in Ag and Area, limited to the processing of raw materials grown on site of the processing facilities or on adjacent parcels. That stays the way it reads?
No, so I'm just providing this language to kind of illustrate if someone came to our counter today and wanted to establish a craft distillery, we would, you know, point them to that footnote, and that could be challenging for certain properties. So the concept of this distilleries ordinance would be to actually have a separate ordinance just for craft distilleries that may or may not have that same restriction on it. I mean, I think the direction would be to get rid of that restriction because that's one of the major obstacles.
I'm bothered by the fact it says similar to winery ordinance. We have many wineries now that, you know, own their vineyards, but they're not necessarily adjacent. In other words, some wineries grow a better Chardonnay over on the coast, even though they're located inland in Paso Robles. It's still their vineyard and it's still their property. So is that that's something that people aren't adhering to very well, or should that be changed? Or how does it say it under the winery part of it?
Yeah, maybe this language may be a little confusing, so I apologize for that. I'm just saying, you know, right now we have a separate wineries ordinance that does not require the, you know, grapes to be grown on the same site as the winery. And the concept for distilleries ordinance would be to set up a similar, you know, process for distilleries where it would not have that requirement and it would have its own separate standards instead of just relying on this food and beverage product manufacturing.
And I can understand the differentiation there, but this caught me right here because if this is the way it is now, it probably should be changed on the winery side anyway, at least.
Yeah. So just to clarify, for wineries, you do not have to grow the grapes on the same property, same site. There's a separate wineries ordinance that does not have that as a requirement.
Okay.
So we can do the same thing for craft distilleries.
Okay, thank you, Erlen. Any other questions on this topic? Okay, hearing none. I guess I'll call for any public comment on this item. If there's any members wishing to speak, Madam Chair, or sorry, Madam Clerk.
Chairman Henry, there are no pre-recorded messages or any attendees with their hands raised for public comment.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we'll close the public comment. Christine, I see you have your hand up.
Erlen, just for my education, when you say craft, is that just basic and anything that has alcohol in it? Or what is that? How's that defined?
I'm actually not sure the history of adding the term craft. I think the concept is that it's smaller scale, not large new manufacturing uses, but just craft kind of small scale distilleries.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay, I think that concludes our workshop topics for today. Alexandria, do you have anything further today? I want to thank both you and Erlen and your teams for putting all this together. It's a lot of material to get through. The comment is kind of like drinking from a fire hose here. So I appreciate the efforts that you've made to educate. Certainly, I've learned a lot this morning. So thank you for that.
No problem. And I want to thank Erlyn and Jennifer and Kylie for their presentations. I think they did an excellent job. And just before I see Commissioner Moltar has a hand up.
I'll take it down.
Okay. I was going to say, just if there's any feedback that your commission has, I know on the 10th we will be in person, so there will be some things that will be structurally different. But the way that things were presented to you today and the flow of the conversation, is this in alignment with what you were hoping to have the experience be? And if not, let me know what changes you'd like to see when we meet again on the 10th.
Okay, I'll put my hand back up. I was just going to ask you, Xandria, could you describe for us what we're going to do on the 10th?
So on the 10th, I'm glad we have a whole day because we have basically all of the other topics that your commission requested. And there's quite a variety of them. I don't have the list in front of me right now, but essentially what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of tackle through and pause and have conversation, then move to the next ones. A lot of the discussion that we have in part two versus what was today was, today was more kind of informational, not necessarily items that your commission would be providing a lot of input or change on, but just to keep you aware of what's out there and what's in process. What we'll be covering on the second will be more of operational things that your commission does and how the information, the analysis that staff does impacts your review process. And so I'm anticipating that the 10th will be more of a, you guys will be talking probably more than I'm talking.
Okay. Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you. Not the.
No,
the
I know line, what you mean. Yeah.
I think Michael probably highlighted what I was going to highlight. That are, you know, certainly my expectation when I kind of broached this idea last year was to look at the processes and procedures and underlying ways that the planning department does business, and not only help. Hopefully the commission help staff do that and provide some feedback in 360 degree, shall we say, look, but also how we can make things better for staff. I know we struggle with a few things in terms of consistency of comment and staff presentations and that other kind of thing. And if we're getting down into that level of detail and working together on that and hopefully help facilitate, then that would be a good win for us, I think. So I look forward to the in-person, Don. Go ahead.
I have a question of Ramona, helpful to us to travel. What is the situation in the parking garages now in San Luis? We don't get our little chits from you anymore, and how do you handle this?
I have parking tickets. Not actual citations, but tickets. And I will give them to you at the meeting. And these, you have to park in the Palm Street garage. And then you present these to the attendant, or they go through the machine. And they are paid parking vouchers for your parking. But you have to park at Palm Street garage next door to the library. And across from the city.
Okay, so these are presented on the way out. You can get in, and then these will let us out.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, very good.
All right. Chair Henry, just to Daniela here, as you prepare to come into the chambers, I would probably recommend, especially for the new commissioners that are not familiar maybe with the board chambers setting, if you want to arrive, you know, 15, 20 minutes before the, you know, start time to allow to kind of get familiar with the equipment and, you know, setup that we will have for you.
Okay, that's good.
And
suggestion.
Also to allow for, you know, for you to find parking, you know, you have to take that into consideration.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you for that. Sure, we're all looking forward to that. So I think,
and I guess also it will allow for introductions because I know a lot of you haven't met each other personally. So it'll be nice for you guys to shake hands or, you know, knuckle.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Well, Okay, if there's nothing else for staff, I think we're ready to entertain a motion to take all testimony and correspondence into the record. And
so moved.
Second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. Madam Clerk, please take a roll.
All those in favor?
Aye. I think we can voice vote that one.
Thank you.
So that's I'm just following the pace of the
your script.
I'm just following my script, so I'm going to make a big thing here.
Okay, then I move that we adjourn to our next meeting on March 10th.
Okay, moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you, staff. Thanks, commissioners. See you in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
And I mean, in person, I'll see you.
Have a good day. That's really nice.
Bye, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. We look forward to seeing you here in chambers.
Thank you. Bye now.